You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei da. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Da Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranusha. E wha akene coming up on the show for City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about the 7.9% rates increase and bus passenger numbers reaching a record high. For politics with Marnie Dunlop from Te Ao Māori News, I caught up with her ahead of today's budget announcement. And News Director Caster attended the launch of Auckland Transport's new hybrid electric ferry. Pranusha, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about the retirement age debate and NZ First's proposed gender bill. I spoke with Dr. Tim Welch about New Zealand's move on orders, and I also spoke with Dr. Alison Towns about New Zealand's new anti-stalking law.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pā, tuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oe wariwari ia hiana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehere rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts, rima toru iwa rima 5395, or give us a call in studio, toru kore iwa toru waru fitu iwa, 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The debate around raising the retirement age has continued this week with growing discussion around superannuation. At the same time, New Zealand First's proposed man and woman bill has reignited debate around gender identity, legal definitions and abortion access. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about these topics. National has signalled support for eventually raising the retirement age from 65 to 67. What's Labour's response to that proposal?
Well, Labour's opposed to increasing the age of eligibility for New Zealand Super from the current age of 65. We want to make sure that, you know, I think of people like my mum, that when they need to retire at 65, that they're taken care of.
A lot of debate around raising the retirement age focuses on affordability, but some people argue the bigger issue is whether around universal super should keep going to wealthy New Zealanders regardless of income. Does Labour think means testing should be part of this conversation?
Labour hasn't considered means testing New Zealand super. We haven't had a chance to discuss this at caucus, but there's not a view that we would make any changes at this current time.
Critics have also pointed out that Maori and Pacific communities already have lower life expectancy on average. How does Labour think equity should play into this?
Well, that's why we think 65 is the right age. I think of my parents, my mum and my dad, that at 65 they needed to retire. They were hardworking people all of their lives, and their bodies were ready to retire at that particular time, and that's where the state should be able to provide the support via super.
At the same time as this retirement debate, the government has also been cutting and tightening a lot of support in other parts of the welfare system. How do benefit cuts play into this broader conversation?
Well, we know that this government hasn't supported people on benefits. That includes people on super. That they want to take away money at every chance that they possibly can and give it to their rich mates, whether that be the tobacco companies or to landlords. You can see where their political choices have been, and that's what we'll probably see today in the budget too.
And what would Labour say to younger New Zealanders that are worried about whether super will exist in the future?
Well, that's why Labour introduced KiwiSaver. It's important that from early in our lives we are investing in our future retirement fund. But there certainly is a role for the state to play, and that's why we want to ensure that when somebody turns 65, that they are eligible for their retirement fund, eligible for super, and that will be there as committed by any future Labor government.
And just moving on to the gender debate bill, NZ First has introduced a members' bill seeking to define women and man in law based on biological sex. What's Labor's response to that bill?
Well, it's a complete distraction from this government's complete failure to fix the cost of living and the economy. It reeks of culture wars. This isn't a priority for New Zealanders. It certainly hasn't come up in my community. And it's important that the government focuses on the things that matter and making change to giving some people respite to the cost of living.
One of the concerns raised about the bill is how this new definition could affect existing legislation by defining women in law as an adult human biological female, how this affects abortion laws. Some advocates see that this bill could create barriers around access for underage people seeking abortion care, as well as transgender and intersex people. Do you think the government and NZ First have fully considered the unintended legal consequences of changing these definitions?
Oh, this is a culture war members bill that Jenny Marcroft has created. It's designed to be anti-trans and is disguised as defining what a man is and what a woman is. But really, the bill changes nothing. That was clear in the first round of speeches last week. And I've heard from communities that, you know, many people support our trans communities and they don't want to see this bill proceed.
What tone does Labor think politicians should be taking when discussing these gender and identity rights?
Well, as governments and as politicians, we have a responsibility to represent all people. And here's an example where the government isn't focused on improving the lives of all New Zealanders. They've used a culture war debate to keep themselves relevant, to distract from their complete failure to fix the cost of living. It's not a priority for New Zealanders, and New Zealanders have been clear about that.
Do you think these debates risk creating uncertainty around healthcare access for transgender and intersex folk?
There's huge uncertainty and fear that's been generated by this government upon our trans and non-binary community. This isn't the first of the rollout of policies from this government. We saw it as they removed the rights of community organisations to make decisions of participation in community sport. We've seen it in the puberty blockers debate, and here we are again on another culture wars topic around definition of what is a man and what is a woman. This is a complete distraction from what the government should be prioritising, which is what our community asks of us, and they want respite to the cost of living.
That was Shannon Halbert speaking about the retirement age debate and New Zealand First's proposed gender bill.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland rates will increase by 7.9% for the next year, as included in Council's annual budget, which passed earlier this week. The rate increase comes as Council needs an additional $235 million each year to run the City Rail Link, which will open in the second half of 2026. And bus passenger numbers in Auckland are back to pre-COVID levels, with a record number of bus trips in March. I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about both of these topics. I started by asking if she thinks 7.9% is an appropriate rate increase.
I think it's the rates increase we have to do. That's the sort of the financial reality of council at the moment. And, you know, we spent months working on this budget. Yeah, we always do. But in particular, it had actually been signalled a long way out that this one was going to need to be 7.9% because that's how much we needed to cover the cost of the City Rail Link opening. So how that works is that we have, you know, obviously it's been built over many years. And once it starts to operate, we have a whole lot of operating costs and owning costs that come from the City Rail Link that previously were being funded through debt, which is not funded by rates, and now we have to shift that to being funded by rates. So it's the reality when a large asset comes onto the book, and this is the largest, that we have to pay for that through rates. So that is basically the whole of the 7.9% rates increase is actually covering the running costs and also what are called the owning costs, so the interest repayments and the depreciation on CRL. You can slice it differently and say, well, you know, some of it's for this, some of it's that, some of it's for CRL. But when you sort of sit down and do the maths, that's most, if not all, of the rates increase. So it was always going to happen at some point. It's just that it's had to happen this year. And we did signal in the long-term plan when we consulted on that in 2024 that this would need to happen this year. And we've stuck to that number consistently.
And how does this compare to increases from other councils?
So far, I think we are tracking, I mean, it's high for us. We've, in the history of Auckland Council since 2010, we've not done a higher increase than this. So it's unusual for Auckland to go this high. But nationally, actually, we always have really low rates increases, and 7.9 is still at the low end. It's interesting to think about Tauranga Council, which only quite recently started to have elections again. Their finances had got so bad that government had to call in commissioners some years ago. And so the commissioners for 3 years were setting the rates, you know, they weren't elected, and they set the rates at whatever was basically needed for the finances without sort of too much political toing and froing. And I think the lowest they set was something like 8, and they had a 15% rates increase in their first year because that's how much money they needed to deal with the fact that they, you know, had a lot of financial costs. There's also some work done by our Wellington City Council last year around comparing their rates affordability to, you know, so how affordable was it to pay the rates given the context of, you know, how much money do people earn in Wellington, what are the house prices, that kind of stuff. And that actually showed that they compared against 9 other centres, including Auckland, and that showed that Auckland had the most affordable rates of those 10 major centres for residential. And I think we were tied for most affordable rates with Palmerston North for the business rates. And then if you consider the fact that in Auckland you actually get way more services than a lot of those other places for the same or sometimes lower rates. One of my colleagues used to live in Dunedin, and she was talking about how the rates on a comparable property in Dunedin were higher than in Auckland, and you got far fewer services than you get in Auckland. So it's all, you know, there's a complex piece beyond just looking at the headline figures.
And you mentioned how something like the CRL has an impact on the rates increase, but I'm curious, how do things like the cost of living crisis and the ongoing fuel crisis affect councils' operating costs?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, we employ a lot of people, and that's one of the things that, you know, when people put up cuts to have lower rates, one of the things that I always keep in mind is often those cuts are people's jobs. You know, that's pay to Aucklanders who are, you know, doing their best, working for the council or working for a contractor on behalf of council, you know, to deliver all of those services and maintain our assets and stuff. And then that's money that they also spend in the local economy that goes round and round. So, you know, that's always a consideration for me. When we talk about cuts, we are talking about usually jobs, and those jobs are held by Aucklanders. So that's always a consideration for me too, and that balancing act. Also, you know, I mentioned before the stuff about rates affordability, so that's looking at rates as a proportion of household costs. The international measure for that is, you know, there's lots of different ways of looking at it. It's hard to compare because it's different things, but the general, just as if it's under 5% of the household's income, that's considered affordable. Ours is usually between 3 and 3.5% that people are paying in rates. And so, you know, well under affordable. I guess one of the things for me is that a lot of the things that council does actually help people in a cost of living crisis. I was at a thing, a community event a couple of weeks ago in Wesley, where everything was free for the community. I was helping out with the sausage sizzle. We gave out 650 free sausages with bread, usually. And there were free ice creams, there was free hot chocolate, there was free entertainment. And the people who came to that were, from my you know, rough assessment, were low-income people who... Oh, and the other thing was they had a big mound of snow for the kids to play with. That was the big attraction, right? So kids who would otherwise never be able to go and touch the snow. And so, you know, that's something that was council funded and put on for free, that otherwise, you know, those families, there's no way they could have afforded to go to Snow Planet or, you know, necessarily go and have an ice cream out as a family. So, you know, there's a lot of things we do that actually mean that we keep the cost of living down for Aucklander, and spreading the cost across everybody through a modest rates increase, I think, is a fair trade-off.
And I want to turn now to ask about the record high numbers of bus trips in Auckland. Why do you think more people are catching the bus, and does it have anything to do with what we were just talking about?
Yeah, I think there's two big factors. One being the cost of living, that people are looking at their car and looking at how much they're paying in petrol or diesel. And even for the people with EVs, the cost of electricity has gone up a lot. And they're looking at the bus and they're thinking, oh, maybe this is a better option for me, because we now have the $50 fare cap. So no matter how much you catch the bus in 1 week, you won't pay more than $50 on your hot card. There are discounts for students and children. The gold card means that people over 65 travel after 9 a.m. for free. That's another thing, actually, by the way, that Auckland Council funds extra from rates compared to the rest of the country, where the government funds just they don't fund the evening peak for free for people with gold card, and in Auckland we do that from rates. Anyway. So I think people are making that shift. I think the other thing is that people are getting a taste and realising, actually, this is quite a nice way to travel now. This is not the bus system of the 1990s, when it used to take me an hour to get to uni from Glenfield, and I had to walk all the way from where they were building the Sky Tower all the way over to uni, and the buses were, you know, creaky and old, and the air conditioning didn't work. And, you know, this is a different bus system now. We've got... much more comfortable, they come more often. Double decker is pretty cool, sitting on the top of this amazing view. Recommend doing it, taking an NX1 or 2 over the Harbour Bridge, just fantastic view sitting up the top. So I think people are starting to realise, you know, this is a viable option from a range of different perspectives.
And how do you think public transport usage, including bus usage, will be affected when the CRL opens?
I think it's going to be a bit of a game changer. I think people who haven't tried a train for ages, because the trains have got heaps better too, and actually a bunch of the trains just having the insides of the carriages redone with new upholstery because they got quite worn. And I actually had a friend, Sabine, if you're listening, Shilda, who sent me a photo of the new upholstery and was like, this is great, this is what we need. We need to have these spaces that, you know, they're public spaces, and trains, in theory. But we need to feel like they're nice places to be. We all deserve that. Anyway, so I think we'll sort of see a sudden thing of people trying it who haven't necessarily, and then hopefully having their aha moment. Actually, hey, this is quite nice. This could be an option for me. I think one of the really big changes you're going to see is around to Waikato Tube Station in Midtown. That area has been quite run down for a while, waiting for this to be ready. And you can already see, the council offices are right there, you can already see the sort of lift that's happening around that area from Albert Street being finished, now Wellesley Street's bus interchange being finished as well. And once that station opens, it's going to be super lively around there and vibrant, and all those shops and businesses are going to get a lift. And, you know, that kind of stuff just builds and builds, which is great.
And I want to finish by quickly asking, Budget Day in Parliament today, do you think there'll be anything in there for Aucklanders?
Sadly, I don't think there will be much in it for Aucklanders. I have to be honest, I am quite depressed about the direction this government's taking in a lot of ways, you know, financially, but also the, you know, pointless attacks on vulnerable communities like the homeless and now the trans community. What I would love to see is some real help for Auckland with public transport subsidies. We, under the previous government, you know, they had free public transport for kids, not just on the weekends, and if we could get something like that in this fuel crisis, and that would help us to, you know, get people looking at, do I have to drive my kid to school? Can they take the bus? That would actually have a lot of benefits, I think, for a lot of families, and also, yeah, obviously reduce carbon emissions and things like that, because we know if a parent has to drive a kid to school, they usually keep driving for the rest of the day and they don't have a lot of options. And I certainly experience that in the school holidays myself, when I have to drive one of my kids to school holiday programs, it sort of cascades the whole day. So that's what I would love to see, would be some public transport subsidies. I'd love to see them allowing us to do a bed night tax levy, give us the money back from GST like happens in Australia, but I don't think we'll see any of that, unfortunately.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on the 7.9% rates increase and bus passenger numbers reaching a record high.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts on any of these pieces, 5395.
Maynard Larkin is shaking things up with his fantastic alt-country debut album, Rattlesnake Boy. And we've made it our album of the week.
Not much in the tank, so I'm driving slow.
That means we have copies of the vinyl to give away to B-card holders. Just stay tuned to breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Rattlesnake Boy, the new album from Maynard Larkin. Available now wherever good music is found.
Yeah, it's a sweet store, great community.
Oi! No dribbling on the vinyl!
Gotta keep the label fiends in line, but they're alright.
Hey, what's the policy? You lick it, you buy it. Yeah, see you at the counter.
Music nerds, am I right?
The Flying Nun Record Store, Karangahabi Road, opposite St. Kevin's, stocking a deliciously curated selection of interesting music, label releases, merch and more. Visit Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahabi Road, or online at flyingnun.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out.
Josh Auraki from Te Whatu Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
Today is Budget Day, when the government will explain how it will spend money and manage the economy for the upcoming year. The budget will be released in full at 2 p.m, but several pre-budget announcements have already been made by the government. For Politics with Marnie Dunlop, I caught up about the Budget Day fanfare and what we can expect. I started by asking what the atmosphere was like at Parliament.
Yeah, for sure. Kia ora tato. Well, your budget, or Tahua 2026, it's always a bit of an affair, and the beehive is, no pun intended, buzzing of lots of activity, and, you know, it's been kind of that the whole week as people prepare for Budget Day, and the technicalities of it, I guess, like logistical sides is quite interesting for people who don't know or haven't been in a lock-up before, is what it's called. So the lock-up starts officially at 10:30, and so all the journos and officials and other media are in the banquet hall, locked up literally, with no access to the outside world, and we're handed the budget on a USB and hard copies, and then we're given a few hours to go through it and write our stories, and then it gets lifted at 2 o'clock, and that's when it goes live, and then the Finance Minister, Nicola Willis, does her speech in the House, delivering the budget, and then the opposition parties have their opportunity to respond, as well as the coalition partners doing their budget speeches, and then after that they come out of the House and then they do their stand-ups with media, and then obviously most media outlets are doing a budget show live. We are on Whakata Māori from 3:30 till 5, and so we'll be kind of rolling interviews of the ministers and other reaction of what the budget might look like and might deliver for New Zealanders.
We've had some clues already about what that could look like. Could you go through some of the key pre-budget announcements?
Yeah, some of the key pre-budget announcements is obviously the quite significant one of the public sector cuts of almost 9,000 jobs, which will save, the plan is to save the government just over $2 billion. That wasn't received well, obviously, especially in Wellington, where they've already faced a lot of cuts in the public sector, and you know, our unemployment rates, especially our youth unemployment rates, which is another story, are extremely high. And so that last year's budget was the pay equity woman wahine paying for the budget, and this year it seems to be the public sector, which has already been slashed significantly. Other areas is obviously social housing and some of the changes and the changes in that they will be for low income for social housing tenants. You know, they're having to adjust the amount in which they give to pay for their rent from 25% to 30%, which could be up to $40 a fortnight for those families in need. So, yeah, those are just some of the pre-budget announcements. Obviously, a few other peripheral ones around education that Minister Sanford has announced and a few other little things here and there. But those are kind of the major things that are quite related to how this budget will be paid for.
Is there any indication about what could be in the budget today? And I'm asking in particular for Māori as well.
Yeah, I mean, going off the last two budgets, there isn't much hope of anything Māori targeted, because last year we saw a massive slash, especially in Māori housing funding, which was put back into the universal pool. The only thing that was given to Māori last year was a top-up for Māori wardens, a little bit in education. So this year, and speaking to Māori economists and other Indigenous advocates earlier this week around what we could expect, the message was pretty clear that we should really be expecting not much at all. And Huhana Linden was just coming past the office before, and we're like, "Oh, what do you reckon?" And she goes, "Oh, well, I would be flabbergasted and probably faint if we have anything Māori focused in this budget." And so it's not looking to make. There may be some sweeteners, what they like to call them. Obviously, you hear a lot of language with budget around lolly scrambles and sweeteners and those sorts of things to kind of an election year, especially to distract people from actually the core issues of the cost of living crisis and also the disproportional impact that Māori face within, you know, our social outcomes. However, you know, it's also really, it's going to be a tight budget with not many treats for anybody, it seems, and that's what they've been indicating, and the Prime Minister has been calling it a growing-up budget, whatever that might look like, and so we'll see. So Māori are not holding their breath for what could be delivered to them, and they're fearing more and further cuts and disproportional impact under this government, as has been shown in the last two budgets.
There's been a lot of discussion about young people in the past few news cycles, and thinking the scrapping of fees free, the high youth unemployment rates, and the continued amount of young people who are going to Australia. So for our student listeners, what should we expect for students and rangatahi more broadly?
Yeah, well, yesterday in the House at question time, this question was put to the Finance Minister around, you know, youth unemployment rates. And as you said, you know, those figures that were the analysis of some figures yesterday, especially around in the regions of, you know, over 40% of young people not in education or training or mahi, and particularly I think most hardest hit was the Opotiki district. And so that question was put to the Minister, and she kind of teased, she was like, there will be something that will cater to young people in this budget, but you know, how long's a piece of string? We're not too sure what will that look like. Who will it be targeted to? Will it be targeted to the regions? Will it be targeted to students, you know, in the main centres? And whether or not also there may be something in the tertiary sector that could potentially be announced as well.
And is there anything else we should know about this budget or the budget process?
I mean, with the fuel crisis and, you know, the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, it's really, it has meant that this budget will be tighter and more so than probably originally planned. So they're trying to kind of manage low expectations, and it'd be hard to leave an election year for the government not to provide something that can kind of, you know, appeal to voters while, you know, for this government and for this coalition government. So yeah, I think because of that ever-changing environment, it's meant that the budget has had to probably adjust in the same way. So yeah, we'll see. At 2 o'clock, everything will be made clear.
That was Marnie Dunlop from Te Ao Māori News ahead of today's 2 p.m. budget announcement.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The government's Move On Order legislation has given police greater powers to remove people from public spaces, including those begging or rough sleeping. Critics argue the bill risks criminalising homelessness rather than addressing its causes. I spoke with Dr. Tim Welch about why he believes Move On Orders punish poverty and what a more effective response to homelessness could look like. And to start broadly, what are the Move On Orders, and what does this new law actually allow the police to do?
So the MUBON orders or the bill will basically allow police to order anyone that's under 14 out of public place for up to 24 hours under who's considered to be begging or rough sleeping or otherwise breaching what would be public order. And you can also get a fine for up to $2,000. And if that fine isn't paid, then up to 3 months in prison.
Now, you've argued that this bill effectively punishes poverty. Why do you see it that way?
Well, we essentially aren't giving people an alternative to being on the streets often. So these are our most vulnerable people, and often the social safety net has kind of failed them. They don't have anywhere else to go. They don't have the means to find shelter. And so by just telling them to leave, we're not really effectively offering anything to these people. We're just telling them we don't want to see them on our streets.
And what do you think policymakers are misunderstanding about the homelessness issue?
Well, part of what we don't understand is really the full cost of not providing free or heavily subsidized shelter to people, job-seeking assistance, opportunities to earn income, or to just be let alone in a way. All of these things, kind of MUBON orders, are really expensive and quite inhumane for people. And other countries who have addressed this in other ways have done so by housing people at a much lower cost.
Supporters of the bill say that MUBON orders are about public safety and preventing disorder. What does the legislation does the legislation solve those concerns in your view?
The legislation mostly just moves poverty and homelessness out of sight of people who aren't comfortable seeing it. The reality, there's not much data that supports that people that are unhoused are violent or have any higher rates of crime, especially in our downtowns. So it's really, there's not a clear connection between people that are visibly homeless and crime.
The number of people experiencing severe housing deprivation has risen significantly in recent years. What does that tell us about the current state of New Zealand's housing system?
Yeah, I mean, these numbers are up quite a bit from the last census. And what it tells us is that housing is not only out of reach for many people who do have a good income, but it's completely out of reach for anybody who's struggling to make ends meet. And we are just not offering nearly enough emergency housing or social housing for the people who need it most.
You also connect this bill to wider government decisions, including cuts to social housing, emergency motels, and mental health funding. Why is it important to view those issues together?
Well, many of the programs that help keep people off the streets or provide support to people who are on the streets and help them kind of move into housing are being cut. Things like frontline mental health services are being cut from funding while we're already short over 650 workers in that field. Those are people that directly help people on the streets. We've lost subsidized income, something that helps people with really low incomes continue to keep a job. Emergency housing is all but gone, so many of our most vulnerable people just don't have anywhere to turn. So all of these things are related to each other, and a cut to one of these is naturally going to lead to an increase in the number of people that are seeking shelter on the streets.
And what would a more humane or effective response to homelessness look like?
We could take a page from the book of what's being done in Finland, per se. So one of the things we could do is provide housing for people that don't have it. And we can provide a basic level of income, a wage benefit that's livable, and better assistance to find employment. And all of those things are a much, much lower cost than MUBON orders or emergency care for people who don't have anywhere else to go.
That was Dr. Tim Welch about MUBON orders, homelessness, and the criminalization of poverty.
Ooh!
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts on any of these pieces, 5395. This is Kōrero Māori from Marlon Williams.
Hoppe, kiraro. Hoppe, oia, ha, ha.
Up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Yesterday, Auckland Transport launched the city's first electric hybrid ferry, set to be operated by Fuller's 360. The ferry is one of four electric ferries, which are set to begin service this year on the downtown to Devonport service. I and Tuesday Wire producer Liam attended the event, where we spoke to a range of people about what the new development means for Auckland. First, we spoke to the vessel's captain, Rob McKnight. What's the main difference between taking this around and taking a different vessel that's running on diesel?
Well, you heard it, it's quiet. There is no noise, so our customers are going to experience peace and quiet. Right on the back deck, you can still have a conversation, whereas with a diesel boat, you can't. You've got no emissions, so we're not putting anything into the environment that shouldn't be there. So we've got a nice, quiet, safe, environmentally friendly platform.
The importance of having this all manufactured and designed in New Zealand, what does that mean to you?
To me, as a New Zealand boat builder, as a New Zealand seafarer, to have it supported here in New Zealand is incredible. Manufactured here, designed by Kiwis, built by Kiwis, integrated by Kiwis, yeah, is incredible. It's about this boat for Auckland Transport doing a route to Devonport. But it's actually about growing our industry. It's about growing our brain power, our strength. Companies we work with, Q West and Whanganui, they've been partnering with Fuller's now for more than a decade. Hamilton Jet, the world leader in what they do. And to have that integrated onto our boat is just incredible.
Next, we spoke to Interim Chief Executive of Auckland Transport, Stacey van der Putten. You mentioned it earlier, how we're working towards having more buses, and now this is a huge milestone as well. What are the goals like for full electrification in the future?
Well, in terms of full electrification, we have a goal for 2035 for our bus network, yeah, and so we're gaining really good momentum now. As I said, 394, so we're over where we thought we would be. There's good confidence in the technology, and that took a little bit of time, but now we got that volume, and actually from 2021 we committed to only procuring electric fleet after that sort of trial phase, which was great. In terms of ferries, it's still a bit of an unknown in terms of when we will meet that timeline. A lot of things to consider in terms of with this fleet, what they can meaningfully service in terms of that. And there's still a little bit of work to understand what that looks like. So we know that right now the electric technology will not meet our outer harbour needs, yeah, but that will evolve over time. And that's a big part of it, right, is we see the big evolution in terms of technology improving, and therefore the confidence of stakeholders for investing in new technology is key. And so this will enable us to collect some robust data to be able to inform future investments so we can get some more low emissions technology for our ferry fleet.
Yeah. And our ferry network, as was mentioned earlier, is a big part of our public transport system, and especially with the opening of our CRL, expanding links in the city. What's the process on integrating our ferry network more in with the other parts of our public transport?
Oh, well, we always aim to match our timetables, so there's good connections for our ferry users as well as our train connections. Obviously, with City Rail Link being operationalised and integrated into the Auckland network later this year, it means that we have a number of bus network changes, and then we will sort of review the ferry timetables to make sure there's good connectivity. I mean, obviously, ferries generally, you know, we have, and you heard the mayor talk about this, our frequent network and we have our rapid network. So making sure that those connections in terms of those connecting services, of which a lot of ferries are connecting type services due to lower frequencies, making sure they match up is really important so people aren't, you know, waiting around to catch the next service. But this is why we have integrated fares, yeah, and it's why we have a one network approach when it comes to the design of our public transport network. So you don't have that modal isolation aspect, and it all works together.
Next, we spoke to CEO of Fuller's 360, Mike Horn. I began by asking him about how the process of electrifying Auckland's fleet is going.
Look, I think it's going pretty well. We've been at this, I mean, we've personally been at this for 7 or 8 years. It's probably 2022-ish. Government actually stepped in and started helping initialise and fund and kick things off, which is why there are a couple of carbon fibre electric boats that started to get built with sort of a $20 million injection into getting that up and underway. We were a little bit involved with that, and the reason for that was we wanted to kickstart an industry in New Zealand around particularly marine but rebuilding boat building industry, and then everything that goes around, let's call it decarbonisation, but it's sort of more than that. And as we sit here today, we've got 4 boats coming in, which are electric boats. There's one in Wellington, the 2 boat building industries in Auckland and Whanganui, which are our biggest ones, are building these boats. So from an industry perspective, that's really starting to work. And is there interest in these internationally? Well, yeah, there is, because the other company we deal with is Vesev, who are here in Auckland, and we've been doing their designs, but we've been commercialising foiling carbon fibre electric boats, and they're selling those overseas. So the depth of experience in New Zealand around marine and electrification and all the things around that is probably the best place in the world at the moment if this is what you're involved with. Really, really exciting stuff.
What's the difference like between developing the hybrid and fully electric ferries, and how do those fit into, I guess, the broader picture of developing the fleet for the future?
Yeah, no, great question, because in actual fact there's so much confusion. So if I look at the boat that we're sitting on, which is called an electric hybrid boat, it's an electric boat. It's exactly the same conceptually as the EVM pure electric boats, which are being built down the road and will end up in this network as well. The only difference with this one is that it's got a backup generator. And when the backup generator, which is a diesel one, is running, it is converting that diesel energy basically into electricity, because this is an electric boat. So they are one and the same, just one has redundancy that the other one doesn't have. Now, once the charging infrastructure goes into Auckland, this one on this route is not going to need that generator. So it's for what if something goes wrong and we need that. But we intend this one will be running 100% electrically all of the time. And that's just the nature of how they've been designed.
Finally, we spoke to Mayor of Auckland, Wayne Brown. In terms of what it would mean for this ferry service to Devonport getting classified as a rapid transport route, why is that important to you?
Well, these are bloody expensive for a starter. You know, they're $56 million. This is about $8 million for a diesel one. So if we're going to do the right thing by the environment, spend a whole lot of money, I want to get a lot of people on them. We've just spent billions of dollars on a railway, and we're making sure that we get lots and lots of people living around the railway stations, otherwise it's a waste of time. So we're going to spend all this money on going to Devonport. I want more people living in Devonport and to make it pay back for what the service we're providing. So it's just straight economics and common sense. And there's room for Devonport to be upgraded a bit.
Yeah, there's been a bit of conversation, especially parts of the shore have been disconnected from the rest of the city on public transport in particular. What could a North Shore look like that was more linked up to the rest of the city via public transport? And is that something that you're interested in doing in the future?
Well, I'd say it's pretty well linked up. We've got the Northern Busway anyhow, but Devonport's kind of right down along a spindly end of a narrow lake road. And people go there and live there and enjoy it and then complain bitterly about Lake Road, which they probably did they not notice it when you went there. And so the best way to reduce the pressure on Lake Road is having people catching the ferry. And we've got a nice ferry now, and so I'd like to get even more people. And then the centre of Devonport shopping centre is all very nice and attractive, but it could easily be nice and attractive, even more attractive, and have six stories of flats of apartments above it, like Ponsonby does. And I live up multi-storey in Ponsonby because that's the way that people and modern people live in. And you're a young guy, you're almost certainly going to live in an apartment in the future or a expensive house way out in the Buai, which makes no sense whatsoever.
And lastly, I wanted to ask about the electrification of the public transport system more broadly. How do you feel about that and expanding Auckland Transport's operations, especially in a more environmentally conscious way?
Well, they've been going pretty well. I think she said we had nearly 400 electric buses now. The one positive thing out of President Trump discovering the Straits of Hormuz is that the price of fuel is going up, and people move from fear and money most of all. You know, there's a few people who move because they really want to do the right thing. Very few people are like they're the outliers, to be honest. People just move from it's cheaper to do that. It's basically cheaper to live in an apartment in the middle of the city near a railway station or a bus station or a ferry station. And so people will do that, which is a good result. It's actually accidentally, environmentally very good. But they do that because if you get the economics right, a good result comes. But if you just yell at people, you know, the idea you can demand a whole lot of fat people riding on a bicycle, that's not going to work. Make it appealing. Just use economics.
That was News Director Kester attending the launch of Auckland Transport's new hybrid electric ferry.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
After years of campaigning from advocates and victims and survivors, New Zealand has introduced a new anti-stalking law criminalising repeated behaviour intended to cause fear or distress. I spoke with domestic violence researcher Dr. Alison Towns from the Coalition of the Safety of Women and Children about the new law and what meaningful protection for victims and survivors should look like. And to start broadly, what does the criminalisation of stalking change in practical terms?
Well, in the past, we didn't have a stalking crime. Most other countries like ours have had one for decades, like Australia and the UK and the US have had one, but we haven't. So what this does is make stalking a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and it puts stalking in the Crimes Act. So it really recognises how serious stalking is and how it can lead to significant harm.
And why has there been such a long campaign for stalking to become a specific criminal offence?
Well, there's been real concern about how stalking has led, you know, preceded very serious offences of assault and murder. And so, there's been quite a concern to push this. I think it's taken a while because other governments have had other priorities. Some of the work on violence has been done on primary prevention, which this government has been basically dismantling, actually. But this government has been prepared to introduce this crime. So that's been good for making it safer for women.
The Coalition of the Safety of Women and Children has said it wants to make sure this law is more than just paper. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. Well, so what we want to do is make sure that that stalking is that the police act on the stalking that occurs. So it's important for people to understand that stalking is sort of any unwanted, intrusive, or harmful behaviour. So things like you can sort of think subtle, if you like, things like surveillance, watching or following someone, you know, things like that in any form, so digital or real life, or AI. It's unwanted contact, so any kind of emails, texts, social media contact, as well as any in-life unwanted contact. Threats or intimidation, and damaging the person's reputation or life through, say, publishing false information or spreading lies or anything like that. Any other behaviour that looks likely to cause fear or distress. So it covers, you know, a good big wide range of behaviours which, you know, just haven't been covered in previous legislation. And it only requires 2 occasions in 2 years for the police to act. And they don't, you know, the police can issue a notice to the stalker to say that they should inform them that their behaviour is causing fear or distress. And if the behaviour then continues, they can arrest and charge them with a crime. So, but they don't have to issue the notice, you know, so that, you know, that doesn't have to be a prerequisite before they lay charges.
And yet, what needs to happen for this law to actually protect the victim survivors effectively?
Well, we need police to act on the law, and the police have been actively educating their officers about what the crime is. So we need to make sure that the police are aware of this new legislation and how it can be used. So this really provides them with lots of new tools to use. And we're already aware that police have laid their first charge. It's a good a tool for when women are really scared or frightened by the behaviour of someone who's following them or watching them or doing anything, you know, making any unwanted contact.
You've also mentioned concerns about stalkers manipulating systems and victims and survivors potentially being charged themselves. How can that actually happen?
Stalkers can be quite manipulative and quite cunning, so, you know, the police need to be very aware of that and to make sure that they know who is actually the primary victim and who is experiencing fear and who's in distress. That's a really important thing. Victims are protected under this law, so if they've engaged in a, you know, they've photographed the stalker and the stalker says because they photographed them that they're stalking, you know, that person, the stalker themselves. You know, victims are protected from doing that. If they're taking any reasonable action, that you know, that might be used to gather evidence for the stalking behaviour, then that protects victims. So there are protections in the new crime.
Do you think people are sometimes underestimating how serious online stalking can become?
I think that this has been underestimated for years. I think it's the harm that's done to people has been, you know, not acknowledged at all for a long time. And I think that it's only really in, you know, recent months, maybe last year or two, when this has been more publicised and the media have, you know, been great actually at letting, you know, providing stories of people who've experienced the stalking events for people to realise just how damaging and harmful it can be. I mean, victims can feel really entrapped in their home, that they can't go out, their studies, their work lives can be affected, their reputations can be damaged. You know, it just closes off the world and narrows it down. And so it's really important that we address it, because it markedly affects especially young women's productivity, so what they can do in life. So, yeah, we need to do something about it.
And what kind of supports do you think victims and survivors need beyond just this new Criminalisation Act?
Well, I think it's really important that we look at where the advocacy is. We do know that there's advocacy already for for young people or women who are experiencing or victims of family violence or dating violence. So this Women's Refuge, you know, this Shine, this the Are You OK, free phone numbers and so on, this Shakti, and this sexual harm organisations, Tone East and so on. We're anxious about those victims who don't, where the person is not, a partner or ex-partner, and because there's limited, there seems to be limited advocacy for them, and, you know, that's a worry for us.
That was Dr. Alison Towns speaking about New Zealand's new anti-stalking law.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. Tēnei rā, that's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Councillor Julie Ferry, Town Māori News' Marnie Dunlop, University of Auckland's Tim Welch, the Coalition of Safety for Women and Children's Dr. Alison Towns, and everyone in Newsdirect Acasta spoke with at the launch of Auckland's new hybrid electric ferry, including Mayor Wayne Brown. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.